Good morning, and welcome to Greater Good. This is your volunteer programmer, Barbara Felix, from the Sun Sounds of Arizona Studios. The Greater Good Science Center studies the psychology, sociology, and neuroscience of well-being, and teaches skills that foster a thriving, resilient, and compassionate society. And now, some articles from Greater Good. Six ways to respond to your child's tantrum. What's really going on when your child throws a temper tantrum? And how should you respond? By Jen Lumenlin, July 21st, 2025. My daughter Karis was two when she discovered the devastating injustice of gravity. She'd been carefully stacking wooden blocks into a tower. It was higher than any structure she'd built before, but the whole thing suddenly tumbled down. Within seconds, she was on the floor, unleashing a wail that seemed to shake the windows. My first instinct was familiar to most parents. How do I make this stop? Later, I discovered that was exactly the wrong question to ask. Research tells us that tantrums aren't breakdowns of behavior. They're breakthroughs of communication. Understanding what's really happening during meltdowns can help us respond to our children in a way that supports them and makes things easier for us too. The science of tantrums. Research consistently finds that tantrums follow predictable age-related patterns. So when do they start? A 1931 study by Florence Goodenough found that tantrums peak between ages 1 and 2 at a rate of 1.4 outbursts per hour of observation, declining somewhat linearly to around 0.6 outbursts per hour at age 5. A tantrum is a negative emotional episode containing at least one set of behaviors, no matter how long the episode lasted. The behaviors included in the set were stiffening of the limbs and arching the back, dropping to the floor, shouting, screaming, crying, pushing or pulling, stamping, hitting, kicking, throwing, and running away. The tantrum officially begins when the first of these behaviors is noticed and ends when the last of them has stopped. Tantrums seem to involve the expression of these emotions that overlap in the tantrum: anger and distress. High anger tantrums include screaming, kicking, and hitting behaviors that peak quickly at the beginning. Distress tantrums involve crying and comfort seeking that increase over time. When Karis collapsed after her tower fell, she wasn't manipulating me or testing boundaries. She was experiencing what researchers call anger distress, a flood of emotions that her developing brain couldn't yet organize into words. It seemed to go on forever, but it didn't. Studies say that most tantrums last 3 minutes, with a majority under 6 minutes. The duration doesn't seem to be affected by the child's mood before the tantrum or the issue that triggered it. If the child stamped or dropped to the floor in the first 30 seconds, the tantrum was likely to be shorter. While you might feel like a bad parent when your child is screaming and kicking, the truth is your child's behavior is perfectly normal and not the result of anything you did or didn't do. Another study indicates that children aged 3 to 4 years have an average of 1 temper tantrum per day, with daily tantrums being considered more normative for children younger than 3 years. When do tantrums stop? While they don't disappear overnight, this research shows that they become significantly less frequent as children approach school age. What is the root cause of tantrums? Understanding what's behind the behavior is the key to experiencing fewer of them. Tantrums aren't manipulation or defiance. They are your child's way of communicating that something important has happened inside of them. When we understand what that is, we can address some of their frustrations and experience fewer tantrums. Independence and physical task struggles. Studies show that frustration often peaks when children try to take on tasks just beyond their current skill level. Karis desperately wanted to build that tower. Her vision was clear, and she was motivated, but her fine motor skills weren't quite ready for such an architectural ambition. The gap between what she could imagine and what she could execute created an emotional storm. But underneath that frustration was an unmet need for autonomy, her deep desire to be capable and independent. Frustration with limits and authority. Older research found that conflicts with authority became increasingly important in the second year of life, actually switching places with routine difficulties as the primary tantrum trigger. When you tell them that they're not allowed to jump on the couch and they immediately melt down, the intensity of their response might seem disproportionate, but for them, it feels overwhelming and unfair. Social conflicts and sharing struggles. Most children don't develop the cognitive ability to share meaningfully until at least 3.5 to 4 years old. Yet many parents expect younger children to share. What we call sharing is actually quite demanding for young children. Sharing a toy means giving up the thing that you have and really want to keep to someone else. This is a concept that young children find confusing because when they have little understanding of time, they can't comprehend how long it will be until they get the toy back, making them resistant to giving it up. The resulting meltdown isn't about the toy. It's about unmet needs for security and control in an unpredictable world. Unmet basic needs. Research consistently shows that several basic human needs, when unfulfilled, commonly lead to tantrum behavior. Sometimes these unmet needs are obvious. If your toddler is hungry and tired, they're more likely to have a tantrum. These physical needs cause tantrums because when our basic needs aren't met, our ability to handle frustration plummets. Other times, the need is less apparent, but equally important. When they're trying to tell you something important about their day, but you're distracted by your phone and give them a distracted mm-hmm, that unmet need for connection, for your full attention and genuine interest, can quickly escalate into a tantrum that you might think came out of nowhere. the best way to respond to tantrums. Your emotional state during your child's tantrum matters more than you might realize. Children co-regulate with their caregivers, meaning they borrow our calm when they can't find their own. Your nervous system becomes their emotional anchor. Number one, stay regulated yourself. When you feel that familiar surge of anger, you know the one, where your chest gets tight and your jaw clenches, try to be mindful of how you breathe. You can try breathing in four counts, holding for four, and breathing out for six. This will give you enough space to respond instead of react. In the heat of a tantrum, it's easy to think, they're doing this to me, or they should know better by now. But when you catch yourself and shift to thinking, this isn't personal, my child is dysregulated, it changes everything. This reframe doesn't excuse difficult behavior. We still need to guide our children toward better ways of expressing their needs. But it helps you respond from a place of understanding rather than that hot surge of frustration that makes everything harder for everyone. Two, understand the phases. The groundwork for tantrum conversations happens long before any meltdown occurs. When you're reading books together, ask about how characters might be feeling. Look at Max's face here. His eyebrows are down and his mouth is tight. How do you think he feels? You can also print a feelings list and ask your child to identify which feeling they're experiencing in calm moments. Just remember that you can't always tell how a person feels from their facial expression. It's always safer to hypothesize. Hannah is crying. I wonder if she feels upset. And then state with certainty, Hannah is upset. Hannah may well be angry rather than upset. During the tantrum, your child's body is constantly communicating. The anger phase hits first and hard. This is when you'll see intense screaming, kicking, hitting, and back arching. During this phase, if you try to offer physical comfort, they'll likely resist your touch. Watch for these signs that the anger is subsiding. The screaming and yelling becomes less intense. Kicking slows down or stops. The rigid, arched posture starts to relax. Crying becomes more prominent than shouting. These shifts signal that your child is moving into the distress phase, when comfort and connection become not just welcome, but necessary for recovery. Three, don't punish, but don't give in. Avoid saying phrases like, you're okay, stop crying, or big girls or boys, don't cry. These messages dismiss your child's very real emotions and can actually make them feel more misunderstood. Don't give in to demands just to stop the tantrum, but also don't use this vulnerable moment to impose additional consequences or punishments. Your child isn't choosing to have a tantrum. They are overwhelmed and they need your help getting back to calm. Finally, avoid taking it personally or responding with your own big emotions. When you match their intensity with anger or frustration, you're asking a dysregulated child to regulate an adult, which is impossible and unfair. 4. Validate your child's experience. The conversation after a tantrum is where real learning happens, but timing is crucial. Wait until your child is fully regulated, not just done crying, but actually calm and connected again. You can use the validation ladder when talking to your kids. And here it is as follows. Be present. Put down your phone, get down to their level, give your child your full attention without waiting for your turn to speak or planning what you'll say next. Accurately reflect. Try saying something like, "What I'm hearing is that you felt really angry when I said it was time to leave the playground. Is that right?" This shows your child that their feelings matter enough for you to really understand them. Contextualize or equalize. You can contextualize by saying, "You've been looking forward to the playground all morning, so it makes complete sense that you'd feel upset when it was time to go." Or equalize with, "Transitions are hard for lots of people. Even grown-ups don't like it when the fun things have to end." Make a proposal. Dig a little deeper with something like, "I'm wondering if maybe you felt disappointed about leaving, but also worried that we wouldn't come back to the playground again so soon." Express true empathy. When you say, "That sounds really disappointing," let your voice carry real understanding. Take action. Consider what you could do differently. "I'm thinking you might have felt more frustrated because I sprung the transition on you suddenly. Next time, I could give you a 5-minute warning so you have time to finish what you're doing." When children feel their emotions are accepted and understood, they're more likely to move through difficult feelings without escalating to a tantrum. This validation approach isn't some permissive parenting technique where we say yes to everything. It's not about throwing out boundaries. It's about understanding what our kids are really trying to tell us when they fall apart. 5. Building support over time. As children develop language and self-awareness, these conversations can gradually include their preferences for support. But this happens slowly, through many small interactions rather than one big discussion. You might notice patterns and reflect them back. "I've noticed that when you're really upset, you like me to sit near you but not touch you right away. Is that right?" Or offer simple choices during calm moments. "Next time you have big feelings, would it help if I sit close or give you some space?" 6. Try to be curious. The next time you witness your child's emotional outburst, or even someone else's, try listening for the message beneath the behavior. What might they be trying to tell you about their inner world? What need might be driving this intense way of communicating? When we approach tantrums with curiosity instead of frustration, we're not just surviving those difficult parenting moments. We're also teaching our children that their emotions matter, that they can trust us with their biggest, messiest feelings, and that there are better ways to communicate when the world feels completely overwhelming. That's a lesson that extends way beyond childhood. It shapes how they'll work through relationships and handle emotional challenges throughout their entire lives. The transformation really does begin with a simple shift in the question we ask ourselves. Instead of, "How do I stop this?" we should start asking, "What are you trying to tell me?" That one change can change everything. About the author, Jen Lumanilin hosts Your Parenting Mojo podcast, which was named Best Research-Based Parenting Podcast by Lifehacker. She holds an MS in psychology in child development and an MED, and is the author of the book Parenting Beyond Power: How to Use Communication, Connection, and Collaboration to Transform Your Family and the World. You are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, bringing you Greater Good Magazine. How hope helps us build a meaningful life. According to a new study, feeling hopeful, even more so than just feeling good, may bring us a sense of meaning. By Elizabeth Hopper, July 22, 2025. Imagine that you've just submitted an application for something important to you. Perhaps it was a dream job, the perfect apartment, or an academic program you're passionate about. As you're waiting to hear back, do you think over what a best-case outcome would be like? Or do you instead try to avoid thinking about it so that you're not disappointed if things don't go your way? According to psychologists, whether we tend to experience hope in scenarios like these can have important implications. And while some of us may be hesitant to hope, perhaps because we want to protect ourselves from future disappointment, hope has a range of benefits. Researchers found that more hopeful people are healthier, as well as less anxious and depressed. Moreover, instead of being wishful thinking, hope seems to prepare us to take productive actions. Those who are more hopeful tend to cope with adversity in more resilient and adaptive ways. A new set of studies published earlier this year in the journal Emotion suggests that hope may have an additional benefit. Those who feel more hopeful tend to also see life as more meaningful. In two studies, over 900 participants reported on their positive emotions, hope, and meaning in life. The researchers used two ways of measuring hope. They asked people about their emotions, for example, "I feel hopeful," as well as their beliefs about whether it's possible for them to bring about a good outcome. For example, "I can think of many ways to reach my current goals." The researchers found that people who were more hopeful, as measured both by their emotions and beliefs, had a greater sense of meaning in life. They also found in one of the studies that the emotion of hope had a stronger link to meaning than people's beliefs about whether they could attain a good outcome. In other words, even if we're in a situation where we don't see how to solve a problem, we can still find meaning if we feel hopeful. Is it possible to inspire a sense of hope and meaning in life? One researcher tells Greater Good that a key strategy is to take time to notice what's going well, whether that's a feel-good story we find on social media or good news in our own lives. She points out that during times of adversity, it can be helpful to remind ourselves that the current situation isn't permanent and things can always change. Moreover, she explains, cultivating this mindset can help us start enacting the changes we need in order to make things better. About the author, Elizabeth Hopper, PhD, received her PhD in psychology from UC Santa Barbara and currently works as a freelance science writer specializing in psychology and mental health. You have been listening to Greater Good Magazine, coming to you from Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer programmer, Barbara Felix, thanking you so much for listening today, and I hope that you have a wonderful rest of your day. And now, stay tuned for more interesting programming, coming to you from Sun Sounds of Arizona.